Dana actually did a PhD in mathematics at Princeton. Then he was a lecturer at Duke University and at Kenyon College for many years. And then had a change in career. He became a science communicator. So he attended the science communication program at UC Santa Cruz. And after that, he did an internship at American Scientist as a science journalist. And then became a freelance science writer. So he's written pieces for Discover Magazine, Science, New Scientist, and he's also written many books. So if you're interested, there's The Big Splat, which is about the origin of the moon. There's The Universe in Zero Words, which is essentially a history of mathematics in terms of equations. And then finally, he's written many installments in a series called What's Happening in the Mathematical Sciences, which is put out by the American Mathematical Society. His most recent book is called The Book of Why, The New Science of Cause and Effect. And this was a three-year collaboration with the scientist who was maybe the main instigator of the new science, Judea Pearl. And it's what we're going to hear about in the talk today. So I've read the book and I recommend it highly to you, but you don't have to take my word for it because the book has been getting rave reviews, and in particular, Science Friday picked it as their 2018 Best Science Book of the Year.
Okay, actually, it's their best.
Right. A best. Great, so before I turn it over to Dana, let me just mention that he's also graciously agreed to be part of our 3.14 discussion series tonight. So if you don't know, at the second floor bistro tonight, we're going to have a little panel discussion. You're welcome to join in the conversation. Conversation starts around 7:30, and there's dinner served before that from 5 to 7. So Dana's going to be there as well.
Okay. Can everyone hear me okay in the back? Good. All right. So thanks, Rob, for the introduction and for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here at the Perimeter Institute. And it's only my second trip to Canada, first trip in the wintertime, and you guys picked a really good time for me to come. So I'm getting a good taste of Canadian winters. So anyway, today we'll be talking about causation. And I've called this talk Mind Over Data because one of the main points that Yudea and I make in our book is that the human brain is a uniquely powerful instrument for understanding causes and effects. We start understanding cause and effect from the time we're infants. We play with things. We say, oh, I wonder what will happen if I drop this plate on the floor. Or we dress up as a princess and we say, you know, how would people talk to me if I were a princess? Or what clothes would I wear? So all of this play we do as children is actually learning about the world and learning how to structure the world in terms of causes and effects. Computers don't play, at least not voluntarily, and they don't learn to experience causes and effects in this way. And in fact, it's going to be a big challenge to teach machines what we mean by cause and effect and how to reason about causes and effects. And in spite of all the hype about deep learning is not really the solution to the problem. We discuss this in our book. So as Rob said, most of this lecture is based on our joint book, The Book of Why, that came out last year. And certainly urge any of you who are interested to pick up a copy. So now it's not really an AI book, even though Yudea, I think, has made his initial mark as an AI researcher. So the first and last chapters of the book are about AI, but in the in-between part, we're really talking about science in general and arguing that that the practice of science as it's done today sort of has a blind spot where it comes to causation. And it inherits this blind spot from statistics, which is the discipline that tells you how to analyze data. And statistics itself has had a very, at best, ambivalent and at worst, hostile attitude towards causation for decades. And that's one of the things that Yudea and I are aiming to change with our book. So before I go on, here's a Here's a photo of my co-author, Yudea Pearl, and I have to say it was an incredible honor and one of the most exciting intellectual experiences of my life to work on a book with him. Besides being a computer scientist and a statistician, I really think he's more than anything else a philosopher and has a philosophical take on the world and also has a great sense of humor. And so it was just really fun and educational to work with him. So, as I said, statistics has had a long and tortured relationship with causation. So in case you can't read this, it says inferring causation from correlation. So this is apparently the scariest thing that you can show to a statistician on Halloween. So here's another example. This is a XKCD cartoon, famous webcomic. And again, on this theme of you can't infer causation from correlation. So what I like about these examples is, of course, they're tongue-in-cheek, and they're funny, but there's a sort of deeper lesson behind them, which is that this message that causation doesn't imply correlation is something that every scientist, or almost every scientist, learns pretty early on in their career. When they take statistics one, they get this message, and they get it loud and clear. And it's sort of become, you know, it's become a joke in a way. But in a way, that joke is, that's actually a problem. Because to me, this joke is like a secret handshake that we have among scientists. Or it's a mark of our induction into the science fraternity that we understand this joke, that we understand about this, that causation does not imply correlation. I don't think the average person who hasn't taken statistics one would know the secret handshake, and I don't know if they would even laugh at this cartoon. I think they might scratch their heads. You know, what? Well, maybe, where's the joke? So. So our jokes actually say something about ourselves. And one of the troubles with making this sort of mantra into, well, this actually completely plausible statement into a mantra or into a secret handshake is that you stop questioning its validity. And you just assume that it's always true. You don't ask when is it true and when is it not true, and what might the exceptions be. So again, Yudea and I are trying to poke a hole in this, mixing metaphors. I was going to say poke a hole in this sacred cow, but that doesn't make sense. Anyway, okay, so what's our message? First of all, I want to say statisticians are right. So on the basis of data alone, you cannot infer causation from correlation. Okay, but that is subject to proviso, on the basis of data alone. But we have more than that. We have our knowledge of the world that's built up over a lifetime of experience of cause and effect. And in this book, we show that if you can combine your data with a causal model, then you very often can get answers to your causal questions. And if you can't, we can actually tell you when you can't, too. Yudea's theory is that flexible. It tells you if you can answer your question, and if you can't, it can tell you what further data you need to collect or what further things you need to add to your causal model. So when I say you can answer causal questions, what are some examples? Well, here are a few. I think the third one's a little bit interesting because it's maybe less obviously a causal question. Does company X discriminate against women? What we're asking there is we observe that this candidate, say, maybe was a man and got a job, and we ask, what if they had been a woman? Okay, or maybe vice versa. We saw they were a woman and didn't get a job, and we ask, what if they had been a man? And so this is really almost the definition of causation, that you're asking, what happens if I tweak one variable? Will there be a change in the outcome? So the first example I want to look at is the second one in that list. So this is sort of a thought experiment, like some of the other examples I give. So if I raise the price of toothpaste in my store, what will be the effect on income? Okay, will the store make more money? Okay. Now, of course, we need some data to address this question. So we're going to assume that the store has historical data on its prices and its sales. And the historical data shows that, in fact, when the price of toothpaste is higher, we make more money. Okay, and As I said, this is a totally fictitious example. I don't know if this is true, but I'm assuming in this example that the demand for toothpaste is fairly inelastic, so that if you raise the price, people are still going to want to buy toothpaste, and so they'll buy about the same amount, even if the price is a little higher. So if there are any economists in the audience, correct me if I'm wrong about that. Anyway, so we have, the store has this historical data, and the question is, does that justify claiming that higher prices cause higher income? So in other words, if I intervene and raise my prices, will that increase our income? Well, we know the example from we know the answer from statistics one. The answer is no, you can't infer causation and correlation. But it's just a blanket answer. So the answer from Idea and me is it depends. So first you have to write down a causal model of the situation, and then we'll tell you whether you can answer that question or not. So here's an example, or actually two examples, of what a causal model might look like. And I'm doing two examples so you can see the importance of the model. Okay. So let me get my pointer, okay, my Canadian pointer. Okay. So in both cases, the observed data is the same. So we've observed that revenue is higher when the price of toothpaste is higher. But here we have two different causal models of what goes on. So this first one is the model where you're a big chain store and you control the market in your area. So I don't know what the big drugstores are here in Toronto or in Ontario. In California, it's CVS. So in this model, basically, the market reacts to us. So if we raise our price, then the market will also raise its price. And so when we raise our price, then the customers are going to see the similar prices at other stores, and so they're going to continue going to us. Or maybe even if they see somewhat lower prices at other stores, they might still continue going to us because we're the big chain and we're the store they're used to going to. So the customer behavior would not change very much. We'd still be selling as much toothpaste, and so our revenue would go up. Okay. Second model is the case where we're a ma and pa store. The market doesn't give a darn what we do. And so if we raise our price, the market price isn't going to change. And in fact, in this model, we have reacted in the past to the market. Okay, so we've set our toothpaste price to what the other competitors are charging. So in this model, if we unilaterally change our price and the market hasn't done anything to provoke that, then the customers are going to leave. And they're going to go to the big chain store where the price is cheaper. Okay. And so our revenue is going to go down. Okay. So same data, two different causal models, two different predictions. Okay. So this shows that the answer to our causal question is not in the data. It's in the data combined with our model. Now, one thing that could puzzle you a teeny bit about this example, and if so, that's good, is you might wonder, in this model, how can I even set the price of the toothpaste? Because the model is showing that it's set by the market price. Well, when we talk about causality, we are talking about interventions, and we're talking about actually breaking the model. So when you do an intervention in a causal model, what you do is you erase all the arrows that lead into the variable you're intervening on. So in this model, there's nothing to erase because there are no arrows going into store price. But in this model, you would erase this arrow and you'd say, okay, I'm setting my price, okay, at this new level. And then you'd go to your data and use that surgically altered model and see what the data predicts for this altered model. If the data even tells you. So intervention means breaking the model. And this is one of the reasons that causality is so hard to program into a machine, because machines follow directions. They do exactly what we tell them to. And they're different from people in that regard. So if you're going to teach a machine to understand causal reasoning, you've got to teach it how to break rules. So fortunately, we're sort of not talking about unlimited breaking rules here. It's a specific way we're breaking the rules, okay? Namely, we're erasing arrows But nevertheless, I think that is a conceptual challenge to overcome. Okay, so let's proceed. Okay, so some lessons from this example. First of all, the data alone don't tell you which model to use. You've got to get that from your knowledge of the business, the pharmacy business. And that brings me to the second point, which is that experience and insight add value to data. They tell you how to analyze the data. So if you're the store manager, you know which situation you're in. Are you a mom and pop that has to follow the market? Are you a market leader? Okay. So the data doesn't tell you that. The data is the same. Okay. Also, interventions alter the causal diagram. And the data collected prior to the intervention, the historical data you have, may not directly answer your question. Okay. But because it's collected under a different regime than what you're proposing. Now, nonetheless, we do have the methods that you can use to answer the question. Okay, so let's continue. Let me do another example. And actually, I watched a talk of Rob's online where he starts with his example. So it's probably familiar to a lot of you. So Simpson's paradox. It's a well-known paradox in statistics dating back to around 1951. And still very much argued about today. In fact, while we were writing our book, a PhD thesis came out where someone wrote their whole PhD dissertation on Simpson's paradox. So in spite of the fact that it's so famous and been studied for such a long time, Udaya has a take on Simpson's paradox that I think is new and really cuts to the heart of why it is a paradox. So here's an example where we've done an observational study of some drug that's supposed to prevent heart attacks. And we've studied how it does among women and how it does it among men, and we've got the total effect. And what we observe, I've done the calculations here so you don't have to, is that among the females, the incidence of heart attack was greater among the people who took the drug. So it looks like the drug is bad for women. Notice I write seems bad for women, because we don't really know, because we're not supposed to infer causation from correlation. Nevertheless, it seems bad for women. And in the second line, we also see that the incidence of heart attack among men is greater. So it sounds pretty bad. But when we look at the bottom line, the incidence of heart attack among people in general is less among the people who took the drug. So to summarize succinctly, the drug seems to be bad for women, bad for men, but good for people. You know, so if you don't know what gender you are, then that's perfect. You know? Okay, so how can this be? Okay, so this is the paradox. Now, one thing that I want to point out, that Udaya points out, which I thought was really insightful, is that there's actually two layers to this paradox. And one of them, he doesn't even call a paradox. He calls it the Simpson's reversal. So this layer that's not a paradox is simply the arithmetic fact that this can happen. And this is surprising to some people at first when they haven't seen it. But what it boils down to is just the fact that the fractions don't add the way sometimes people think they do. And so all you have to do is go home and play around with some numbers, do some examples, and see that, yeah, A over B plus C over D is not A plus B over C plus D. It's something different. And that enables, you know, this total to have a different proportion. So if this were just an arithmetic puzzle, it would not have been a paradox for 70 years. So it wouldn't be something people would still be writing PhD dissertations about, because statisticians are smart people. They can figure out arithmetic. So it may take a little getting used to, but you get used to it. Okay. So that's not the paradox. The paradox involves causation. Okay? And so we start understanding the paradox when we write down a causal diagram. Okay? So we have three variables here, gender, drug, and heart attack. And the thing you may or may not have noticed back on the previous slide is this was an observational study. Okay? Of course, it's fictitious. This never took place, but OK. take my word for it, in this fictitious world, this was an observational study. So people were free to decide whether to take the drug or not. And what we see is that for whatever reason, 40 out of 60 women chose to take the drug, and 40 out of 60 men chose not to take the drug. So there seems to be a very strong effect of gender on the choice to take the drug. And so we indicate that in the causal diagram by drawing an arrow from gender to drug. Okay. Of course, gender also affects your risk of heart attack. Men are more likely to have heart attack. And so we have an arrow pointing that way. And this sets up a sort of forking situation. And this is the classic, the sign of what's called a confounder. Okay. So gender is a confounder of drug and heart attack. Now, one of the cool things about causal diagrams is that they make it super easy to identify confounders. All you need to do is look for this forking pattern. It's a little more complicated than that. You know, if you have more complicated diagrams, there's a somewhat more general definition of what a confounder is. But nevertheless, it's a fairly easy definition to learn. You can play around with a few examples, and you can master it in a day. By comparison, statisticians have been arguing about what is a confounder for decades. And they kind of have, you know, some rules of thumb about what a confounder is. But there's still no really good definition in principle of what a confounder is, because such a definition would require them to talk about causation. And they aren't allowed to talk about causation by the rules of the discipline. So they've really struggled with this. With causal diagrams, it's super easy. Now, when you have a confounder, and you want to find the effect of the treatment on the outcome, you need to control for the confounder. And what that means is you break the data up into categories. So we break it up into men and women. And then you average the effects in those two categories, reweighting it according to the prevalence in the population, not the prevalence in the sample. Okay. So since men and women are equally prevalent in the population, you just average the two risks that I showed you on the last slide, and you'll find that, in fact, the drug increases the risk of heart attack. And so our conclusion is that drug A is bad for men, bad for women, and bad for people. And so the paradox is resolved, and we can be, you know, can breathe a sigh of relief that we didn't take this drug. Okay. So, but let me talk about why was this a paradox? Now, why did we have such a strong reaction? And you all laughed at it when I said the drug was bad for men, bad for women, and good for people. It's because these words, bad, this word bad for, we interpret in a causal way. Our brains are wired to, or else we learn, to interpret the world in causal terms. So when we see bad for women, we interpret that to mean, if I'm a woman and I take this drug, it will increase my risk of heart attack. That's a causal statement. So these statements are being read as causal statements, and our intuition about causation that we've, you know, been developing since we were 2 years old is telling us this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense. So if Simpson's paradox were just about the arithmetic problem, you know, we've only known about fractions since we were maybe 7 or 8 years old. So that's not going to violate your sense of reality in the same way as a statement about causation, which you've been learning about since you were 2 years old. So that just seems really wrong to us, and it just feels we can't accept this. So I think Uday is right about this. This is why we call it a paradox, because it violates a very deep-seated belief from our experience. Okay, let me do another version of Simpson's paradox, where we have another drug, and this drug is also supposed to reduce your risk of heart attack, but it does it by lowering your blood pressure. Okay, and so we do the same observational study, and look, we got the same data, same numbers. Isn't that amazing? So now let's see what we conclude from these numbers. Okay, so remember, we're going to combine the numbers with a causal diagram to guide us. Okay, so we have to put down a causal diagram. Now, in this case, the drug is supposed to affect the blood pressure. That's the whole mechanism by which the drug works. So that means we draw an arrow from drug to blood pressure. And so blood pressure, it's not a confounder anymore. It's a mediator. Okay? That's the word for the mechanism by which the drug operates. The rules are different for mediators. So you don't want to control for a mediator because the mediator is actually the way that the effect is supposed to take place. So if you controlled for blood pressure, you would be not allowing the effect to happen. And what we would observe in the data would maybe be no effect, or as in this case, maybe you'd actually observe a negative effect. In any case, it would be a biased estimate of the actual effect on the drug on the heart attack, of the drug on the heart attack. So you don't want to control in this case. So in this case, instead of looking at line one and two, you look at the bottom line. Okay, you look at the aggregated data. And the aggregated data tells you the risk is lower of heart attack if you take the drug. And so that's what you should pay attention to. That's the unbiased estimate of the effect of the drug. And so you conclude that drug V actually looks good. Okay? And in fact, the way it works is by moving people from the high-risk category into the low-risk category. And this, by the way, explains this sort of puzzling data we saw, because you might ask, well, but why was the risk higher among people with high blood pressure? Well, if we measured the blood pressure after they took the drug, okay, then and they still had high blood pressure, that meant they probably had really high blood pressure to start with. So they were the higher end of the high-risk category. And so it's no wonder that the people who are left had a higher risk than the people who never even took the drug to start with. Because this group includes both the high end of the high risk and the low end of the high risk.
But if the drug is going to be prescribed, it's not about, like, we know the patient's blood pressure. So
okay.
I mean, it is not a random person. It is a specific person, and the drug should be designed according to that person. But it seems like whether or not the person has low or high blood pressure, it still seems bad for that person.
Let me try to say again. So one thing I perhaps should have said is that we're measuring the blood pressure after they've taken the drug because the mechanism is that the drug is affecting the blood pressure. So I should have said low blood pressure after taking the drug, high blood pressure after taking the drug. So when we look at the control group, those people didn't take the drug, and they include people both at sort of the low end of the high-risk group and at the high end of the high-risk group. Okay. Now, when they take the drug, that's going to move the people at the low end of the high-risk group, going to move them into the low-risk group. Okay. And so the only people who are left are going to be the people who are at the high end of the high-risk group, and they're going to have a higher rate of heart attack than this category, which includes both the low end and the high end of the high risk group. So I don't know if that addresses your question, but that explains why the drug appeared bad for people with high blood pressure, but actually it's not. Okay, that was only an appearance. Okay, and when we understand the data better, thanks to using our causal model, we understand why this percentage was higher than that percentage.
Okay. All right. The initial distribution of blood pressure, was it uniform? Was it like peaked somewhere? Or like?
Well, so I am totally, I am totally waving my hands over any details of the distribution. Basically, I'm just saying there's low blood pressure and high blood pressure. But actually, from my discussion, you can see that I'm kind of actually, I'm talking about the low end and the high end of the high risk category. So it would be nice to have a finer distribution. But the paradox can occur. So, I've illustrated with binary data, with binary variables for simplicity. But Simpson's paradox can occur even if you have categorical data with more categories, or even if you have continuous data. So this is intended to be a pedagogical example. So, yeah. Okay, so. So anyway, the overall message from this example is that the causal diagram tells you how to analyze the data. So for one drug, the conclusion was that the drug does not prevent heart attacks, and for the other one, the conclusion is that it does. And how we analyze the data is dictated by the causal diagram. So that's the key message. And I think also an important message was this one about why is it a paradox? It's a paradox because it violates our notion of causality. And if we properly understand the causal effects, the paradox disappears. Okay, so a drug cannot actually be, raise risk, the risk for women and raise the risk for men and lower the risk for people in general. All right, so how much time do I have? Okay. All right, well, I'll talk about this one too. So my favorite example in the book has to do with my dog, Daisy. So these are some pictures of her when she was a puppy, and it's actually four different photos. So she was doing this, looking at the camera. It was a lot of fun. So one of the things about Daisy as a puppy was she had a hard time being house trained. And so she was still having accidents, pooping and peeing in the house for several months. And my wife and I were at our wits' end. But a funny thing happened. So we foster kittens for the animal shelter. And so we brought in a litter of foster kittens for a couple weeks. And while the kittens were there, Daisy stopped peeing and pooping in the house. And we thought, oh, wow, OK, we've solved the issue. But then when the kittens went back to the shelter, she started peeing and pooping again. So this is looking like a causal relationship between having other pets in the house and having her obey her house training. So we were wondering, why did this happen? My wife's theory was that perhaps having the kittens around made her feel as if she was in a pack, and she didn't want to mess up the area where her pack was. So dog psychology here, okay? Kind of a hard hypothesis to test, but a plausible one. So at the time, I was actually in the midst of writing the chapter on mediation. And so I started thinking about it in terms of mediation. And I thought, hey, wait a minute. When the kittens were here, Daisy had never seen a kitten before. And she thought they were toys. So she was like dragging them around the living room and wanting to throw them and stuff, which we did not want to encourage. So actually, when the kittens were out, we put her in a crate. Or else we held her on a leash, even though she's inside, to keep her apart from the kittens. Now, both of these interventions, crating and leashing, are recognized tools for house training. And so I thought, oh, maybe she started behaving better because we were training her better. We were doing what you're supposed to. And so there's this indirect effect via crating and supervision. So the question is it a direct effect through the dog psychology, or is it indirect effect where it's through our psychology that we were doing what owners are supposed to do? So I want to do this example because it shows that not all causal questions are simple things of what caused this to happen. We call our book the book of why, and one meaning of why is when you actually know what the cause is, but you want to know how it operates. So, one type of why question is, why did the dog get better? But another type of why question is, why did the kittens help her behavior better? What was the mechanism? Okay. So this is a very important kind of question in science. Scientists are looking at mechanisms all the time. And this is a great thing you can do with causal diagrams. So, after the kittens left, I suggested we could do an experiment. So we could remove the kittens. Well, we'd already done that. And then supervise the dog as we would have if there had been kittens there. Okay. So it's a two-pronged intervention. And it's actually a counterfactual intervention, because we had to determine what would we have done if there had been kittens here. Okay. So the experiment was actually not all that successful. She did have some accidents, and I think that we did not successfully reproduce the condition of crating and leashing. So what it kind of taught me was how hard it is to do an experiment. It didn't really teach me anything about Daisy. But it's still really interesting. And I think one thing that's interesting to me is that my wife perfectly understood the logic of this experiment. And she's not a mathematician. She hasn't been trained in causation or anything like this. And yet she got this. I didn't have to explain at all why this is the right experiment to do. And the reason to me is, again, the fact that our brains are programmed and are taught from a very early age to think about causes and to learn how causes work. And so so even without any fancy theory, she got this. Yeah.
If you carried out this experiment and the dog was pooping, isn't that proving
the Yeah, well, okay. So, yes, it is possible. Right. So if I did it successfully and she was still pooping, then that definitely is evidence that my wife is right. And so I should probably, you know, say that, you know, yeah, my wife was right. Well, I just wasn't actually convinced that we did the experiment right. So, yeah, oh, well, anyway. Okay, maybe she was right, but at least, okay, well, at least we have a way to tell, okay, and in fact, in the mediation chapter, you will see how you can actually do this experiment. If you can't do the experiment, you can still sometimes get an answer from your data and from your causal model using something called the mediation formula. So. All right, let's see, how much, okay, doing okay. Now, the examples I've talked about so far have all been kind of thought experiments and fictitious data. So I wanted to show you one where the data was real, and it was a real paper. Appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1998. So the authors were doing an observational study of elderly men. And their question was, does exercise improve various health outcomes, including the most basic health outcome, mortality rate? And what they found was that, in fact, people who walked 2 miles a day or more had a much lower mortality rate than people who exercised, who walked 1 mile a day or less. So the natural question is, does walking increase your lifespan or reduce your mortality rate? Well, this is a causal question, and so we should draw a causal diagram. And actually, even without a diagram, you could probably guess what the problem is that we're facing. Namely, that the people who exercise more may exercise more because they can. They're healthier, they're younger, et cetera. So we should definitely control for things like age and overall health. Okay. So in fact, that's what the authors did. And after controlling for everything they could think of, they still saw a dramatic reduction in mortality rate for the people who exercise, who walk 2 miles a day or more. So to me, this is pretty impressive. It should be like front page news. And it looks like a causal effect. Now, did the authors say that? Well, here's what they said. Of course, the effects of intentional efforts to increase the distance walked per day, i.e. an intervention, cannot be addressed in our study. So they refused to say that walking will improve your lifespan or mortality. Okay. And I agree with everything in their paper except those two words, of course. Because those two words show me that they drank the Kool-Aid, they accepted the indoctrination when they took statistics one, and they were indoctrinated to believe you can never talk about causation in an observational study. And so they say, of course, you can't do it. They never even thought about it. Okay. And so our big message is, of course, we can address that question. And even more, we should, because science is about causes and effects. If you're a doctor talking to a patient and they want to know, they don't want to know, is walking associated with lower mortality? They want to know, if I walk, will I live longer? Okay, is there a causal effect? So giving them something else is not going to cut it. So you might ask, well, were these authors unusually cautious? You know. Well, I don't think so. In fact, if you look at the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is one of the most prestigious journals in the country, there's a blog that's written by the editors. And 2 years ago, they wrote in this blog, if it isn't a randomized controlled trial and is a report of an observational study, then all cause and effect language must be replaced. So in other words, if these authors had submitted to JAMA and had tried to say that walking reduces the mortality rate, they would, the paper would not have been accepted, or else they would have had to change the wording. So that shows the depth of penetration of this prejudice and this sort of secret handshake into science, that it's an explicit policy of one of the most prestigious medical journals in the country. So again, you don't, yes?
But I think there's many variables here which would be hard
right.
to you know, take into account in such a study. There would be sampling bias, there would also be what kind of food these people are taking while they're doing intentionalized walking, and thus, you know,
right.
the kind of nutrients that they yep. increase or decrease.
Right. Okay, so the question was that there are lots of other factors to take into account. Well, the point is that the authors did their homework. They did record everything that they could on, you know, every confounder they could on age and various other health factors. So they did the best they could. Now, you could always say, well, maybe there's some other confounder out there that we haven't thought of. Okay. But my argument is, if you've controlled for all the obvious ones and it still barely moved the needle, you know, we still got like a twofold reduction in mortality, how likely is it really that some unobserved, some other confounder that you've never even thought of is going to swing the needle all the way over to where there's no difference? So at some point, your knowledge of the subject and your sort of understanding of what's plausible has to say there's no way that there could be another confounder this important. I talked about this recently with Udaya, and because someone had asked him in an interview, you know, how do we come up with these causal diagrams and how do you agree on them? And of course, over and over, you're seeing in these examples, it's important to get the causal diagram right. If you have a causal diagram that doesn't reflect reality, then you're going to get wrong answers. And this is scary for statisticians. Okay, so statisticians want to have a cookbook model that will work for any data. Okay? So it is important to get the model right. And if you missed a confounder, an important confounder, you will get the wrong answer. But our argument is that that's what the training of the scientist is for. These epidemiologists are trained in what things usually confound the variables they're looking at. And so if they've done everything they can think of, then at some point they have to commit themselves. They say, okay, we have controlled for everything. We don't think that there's anything else that can explain the effect. It must be the walking. And we want to legitimize that. We want to give them the right to say that, whereas JAMA is not giving them the right to say that. So it's not giving them the right to be scientists and to use their knowledge of the discipline. And it's a really fundamental problem in statistics that statisticians have, in some sense, enforced ignorance on scientists, because you always start with the null hypothesis, which is assuming you know nothing about the effect you're looking at. Well, we want to legitimize that you're allowed to bring in your knowledge of the subject, your expertise, and also the expertise of all the other people in your discipline. And not only that, okay, so it may be that people will disagree. So you put down your causal diagram, and it may be that, you know, you're some other guy in some other lab will say, that's not right, here's what the causal diagram should look like. Well, that's great. That means we're having a debate over the issues. And so Udaya says, how do you get the right diagram? By argument. So, you know, so you argue with your, you know, with your colleagues over what the data means and so forth, and you try to get a consensus. And, you know, and maybe you can arrive at a consensus, or maybe you'll find it doesn't matter that in both of these diagrams the answer is the same. Or maybe it does matter and you won't get the same answer, but in that case, you've got to do science, okay? You've got to do science and not statistics. So, you know, that's our book, our message is do science and be allowed to bring it into your data analysis. So I'm sorry, I get passionate about this, but I hope that answers your question. Yeah, you know, my wife's telling me, don't start getting agitated in your lecture. All right, okay. So the good news is that this is changing. Okay, so in the American Journal of Public Health had a special issue last year where they had 7 papers that addressed causation, and all of them, to one degree or another, endorsed using causal inference. And this is a good quote from Miguel Hernan from Harvard, who says, arguably the biggest disservice of traditional statistics to science was to make causal into a dirty word, the C word that researchers have learned to avoid. So we're about giving them that C word back. This was an interesting example from this year. So January 2019, a paper in the Annals of the American Thoracic Society called Control of Confounding and Reporting of Results in Causal Inference Studies. So we're talking about causal inference. And the interesting thing is this paper is signed by 47 authors who are all editors of journals in respiratory medicine, critical care, well, you can read it, sleep, et cetera. Okay, so they're all editors. And here's what they say. We urge authors to consider using causal models when testing causal associations. The scientific, mathematical, and theoretical underpinnings of causal inference have evolved sufficiently to permit the everyday use of causal models. So what a change in 2 years. Okay, and well, this change really has been going on longer than that. But I just think it's an amazing contrast. And Uday and I were so thrilled to see this public statement by 47 editors that, yes, you can, and we encourage you to use causal diagrams. So in fact, they gave some nice examples. And so again, I was so excited by seeing this. So A is an example where we see confounder. Okay? In B, we have an example of a mediator, immune function mediating between exercise and lung cancer. C shows something I haven't talked about yet today, but is also really important in causal inference, namely colliders, when you have two arrows pointing to the same variable. That leads to some really interesting paradoxes, which we talk about in our book. And finally, the one I love the best is D. This is something called M bias. And this was discovered by Uday. So it's a situation where many statisticians would automatically control for this variable called crackles. So I assume this is something that the doctors hear when they listen to your lungs through a stethoscope. So if this is something that occurs before the treatment, this is something that statisticians would automatically control for. And what Uday showed, and it's easy to show with causal diagrams, is that you should not control for that. If you do, then you're going to open up what's called the backdoor path, and you're going to get a bias. So what's interesting, when Uday first started talking about M bias, the reaction of statisticians was, oh, you'll never see this in a real world problem. You know, it's so implausible to have this relationship of the variables. But now that people are taking causal diagrams seriously, the respiratory biologists themselves come up with something. It's easy. They say, OK, yeah, here's an example of that pattern. So it's sort of a shift in mindset. Once you accept that this is a tool you can use, all of a sudden, you start seeing examples everywhere. So OK, I'm getting kind of low on time. So I'm going to have to, boy, I'd like to do this one too. We have a whole chapter about the smoking lung cancer debate. And I certainly encourage you to read it. So this is another type of causal diagram that Uday discovered, where it's possible to control for confounder even if you can't observe that confounder. So previously, you know, the examples I gave you, I said, what do you do with a confounder? You control for it. And to control for it, you need data on that confounder. Okay? But here's a case where if you have an intermediate variable between the treatment and the outcome, you can actually use that to isolate the effect of smoking from the effect of this putative smoking gene that debatable whether it really exists. So so the point here is that we have a procedure that would work for any situation where you have a confounder and you have a mediator that is not affected by the confounder, or is shielded from the confounder. And I love this word shielded was suggested by Uday. It's such a great word because it brings up images of, you know, stepping into the diagram and putting a shield there to keep the arrow from going from the smoking gene to the tar. Very, very causal word, you know, a beautiful verb. And so again, you know, you could say maybe this is implausible. I don't think this is implausible. I think that once people accept this and start looking for it, they're going to find examples like this. Even if it's not plausible for this particular example, they will find examples where it's plausible, just like the M-bias diagram I showed you. Okay, so in summary, this is what causal diagrams can do for us. They can tell us what experiments to conduct, as in the DAISY example. They can tell us how to interpret our data, as in the Simpson's paradox examples and most of the others. They cure the fear of confounding. They tell us what a confounder is and what isn't. And they give us new ways to extract causation from association, as the front door criterion that I just showed you tells you. Now, I said this, it wasn't a book about AI, but we do talk a little bit about AI at the end, and I want to get back to that. So we argue that machines will need to understand causation and need to understand causal diagrams. So what happens if you have a machine learning program that doesn't understand causation? Okay, well, this is what happens. So this is the Uber car, self-driving car, that collided with a pedestrian in Arizona last year and killed her, the first fatality involving a self-driving vehicle. And I thought it was very interesting to read the National Transportation Safety Board's report on this. So they said the cause of the accident was software failure. So what happened was that the car, 6 seconds before the collision, detected the pedestrian. It didn't realize right away that it was a pedestrian. Okay? But 1.5 seconds before the collision, it did realize it was a pedestrian and determined that an emergency braking maneuver was necessary. Now, as you can see from the picture, the emergency braking maneuver didn't happen. In fact, the car collided with the pedestrian at about 40 mph. And so obviously the NTSB asked, why didn't the emergency braking happen? Well, turns out that Uber had programmed the vehicle when it went into autonomous driving mode. They disabled the emergency braking assist on the vehicle. Okay. Now, why would they do such a ridiculous thing? Well, we can only speculate. I don't work for Uber, and no one at NTSB did either. I did talk with one expert in this area and read an article by another that both said the same thing, that they believe that Uber was having troubles with spoofing. So the car would see things and think that it had to brake. So it would brake for a sign, it would brake for an overpass, it would brake for a tree. And obviously, a car that's slamming on its brakes every time it sees a tree is not safe to put on the road. And so how did they deal with this? Well, they didn't deal with it by addressing the problem, which is that the car doesn't understand what is a threat and what's not a threat. Instead, they dealt with it by turning off the emergency braking. So a completely wrong-headed approach, but those are the consequences. So if we're ever going to have machines interacting with us in our daily lives in unconstrained circumstances, where rules get broken and where things happen that aren't supposed to happen, you know, that pedestrian's not supposed to be there, we'll need machines that can handle causality. And a day after I gave this talk for the first time, I actually had an experience that really brought home to me how big a problem this is. So I was driving along the road, and I saw a pedestrian ahead of me. And I noticed this pedestrian was looking over his shoulder. And immediately, I understood what that meant. I understood that the pedestrian wants to cross the road. And so I slowed down. And sure enough, he crosses in front of me. How do you teach a self-driving vehicle to recognize the pedestrian's motions and to recognize the pedestrian's intentions? So that's a really challenging causal problem. And so understanding causal diagrams is a first step. It's not the last step. Okay. Another step, which we actually don't talk a lot about in our book, but I wanted to mention because it came up yesterday when we were talking, is causal discovery. And that's when you actually have the machine learn come up with the causal diagram on its own instead of programming it in. Because it's going to be impossible to program into a computer every single rule we've learned over our lifetimes, that when somebody looks over their shoulder, they want to cross the road. I didn't even know that rule until I saw it happen in front of me, and I knew what the pedestrian wanted to do. So you're never going to be able to program everything into the computer. It's got to be able to learn causal diagrams for itself. And so as I said, that's called causal discovery. It's a harder problem. And Udea's work is relevant there. I'm not sure that the problem is solved by any means at this point. But in any case, these are some signposts on the way to actually getting to strong machine intelligence. So I think that I will. Yeah, this is an article we wrote for the New York Times, or sorry, Wall Street Journal. And let me go to the end. Okay. All right. So anyway, so there's our book. If this isn't a conventional book reading, but if any of you have copies and would like me to sign them, I'd be glad to do that. And I even have copies available that you can buy. I brought three copies with me if anyone wants to buy one. But that's completely optional. Anyway, so I appreciate your attention, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
So let's start with any questions from the students.
Yeah.
This was really interesting. Thank you again. And I was wondering if you have considered feedback loops, or if you have causation going both ways.
That's a great question. Yeah. So one thing I kind of zip by on one of those transparencies is that what these things are called in the literature is not causal diagrams, but directed acyclic graphs, or DAGs. And we chose not to use that term in the book because we wanted to avoid scientific sounding jargon. And so we call them causal diagrams. But one assumption in directed acyclic graphs is that you don't have loops. And so you can't get feedback. Now, in the real world, you do have feedback sometimes. And so there are various ways you can deal with that. One is you could have a time element in your causal diagram. So you have this variable at time one and at time two and time three. So you can then get feedback. There may be situations where also where you can't tell which way the arrow goes. And so you can, there are tools to deal with that as well. Where feedback causes a problem is that they sometimes keep you from having convergence. His whole theory is based on Bayesian networks. And so you get convergence very nicely in Bayesian networks if you don't have loops. If you do have loops, you can get it, but it's a little bit more of a problem. Yeah.
Thanks.
Other questions from students?
Did you want to ask her?
If I understood correctly, you made an argument about that the scientific journals, let's talk about medicine, for example,
yeah,
as the in example you have given, should use more more of a language of causation. I'm trying to understand your point, because the way I was thinking was that there were different kinds of scientific writing, like those that published the experiment, the study, and those that, like scientific journalism, or those that the doctors actually use to treat their patients, and those that, that are used for application of those studies, would, I guess, even if, we have thousands of studies about a certain drug cures a certain illness, which may still not be called a causation, only a correlation, but the doctors will indeed use those studies to treat their patients.
Yeah.
So why should we why should we remove that distinction between the writings of pure studies and those that are intended for application?
So that's a great question. So he's asking, we're being recorded, so I should repeat the question, right? So, yeah, so he's asking, why should we ask scientists to use causal language when they're talking with each other? And he says, you know, the doctors will use causal language when talking with their patients. So, and that's true. I mean, doctors have been telling patients for, you know, since forever that taking this drug will help you. And so doctors are able to see through to read that study, and they draw their conclusion that they think it is causal. But so my argument would be, why should we force scientists to use a different language when talking to each other than they use when talking with the public? So if you have done your homework and if you've controlled for the things, everything you can think of controlling for, you should say that, okay? Now, it's true that the public isn't going to read JAMA very much or New England Journal of Medicine, but one group that does is journalists, and they will always leap to the causal conclusion. And they might not do it. They might do it when it's not justified, because they're not going to look at, did they control adequately for the confounders? They're just going to say, look, walking is going to reduce your risk of your mortality rate. So it's actually very important for scientists to do this so that they can say, okay, this study is claiming causation. And so go ahead and write your journalistic article. This study is not claiming causation. And so don't say it. Don't say it is. So I think it's important for communicating with journalists and through them to the public to say what we really mean. And, you know, and if what we really mean is that walking is going to help, you know, is going to help you live longer, then say that. You know, but don't let the journalist say it. Because if the journalist will say it when you don't really mean it, and then you have a problem. Or, you know, so, yeah.
I recently read an article in The Economist, and yeah. I will even say, and I mean, it's a journal, it's a intended for read of general public, mm-hmm. and right. I thought that it wasn't paying attention to distinguish between causation and correlation, and yeah. In my opinion, their conclusion was not rigorous.
Good.
When I checked their sources, mm-hmm. The sources did actually use correlation language, which mm-hmm. was correct. So mm-hmm. by lifting that distinction, we are risking that rigor. Yeah. And
so we're not risking the rigor because the methods we have are rigorous for taking observational data if you agree on the causal diagram. Okay, if you and I agree on this causal diagram, and we agree on, and we have the data, we will come to the same conclusion. So, so the one way that Udaya puts this is that the conclusion is conditional on the diagram being correct. Okay. But if we do agree on the causal diagram, then the conclusion is completely rigorous. So if you and I agree that that is the causal diagram for walking and mortality, or you know a few more confounders, but then if you and I can agree on that, then the conclusion is rigorous that walking will cause a reduce in mortality. And if the conclusion is, so we should allow scientists to say, when is this conclusion rigorous? And then the journalists will be within their rights to talk about the causation. But if we cannot say, right now, we don't allow them to even say whether it is or isn't rigorous. And so the journalist is free to extrapolate in any way he feels, you know, will sell the paper. And of course, he's going to say, he's going to use the causal language. Because either by lack of knowledge or because he thinks the readers won't understand the difference between correlation and causation. Anyway, so by depriving scientists of the ability to make this distinction, we leave it up to the journalists. And that's not where that responsibility should be. So I'm saying put the responsibility where it should be, in the hands of the scientists. And if there's disagreement on the causal diagram, great. Then we have something, the scientists have something to argue about, and they can decide eventually which causal diagram is right.
So related to this question, Do you have any ideas how to rank or quantify the credence we have in our causal conclusions?
Yeah, so all of these, you know, one thing I barely even touched on here is that all of Yudea's methods are quantitative. And so when we give an answer to the causal question, it will be in the form of, you know, you'll have a probability or something, and you'll have a confidence interval. So all of that, you know, all of that baggage comes with Bayesian networks. So the fact that the structure is built on Bayesian networks means that you have access to that. So yes, you can say, instead of just saying, you know, walking reduces mortality, we can say that you know, 2 miles of walking will reduce, you know, the average mortality by X percent with, you know, plus or minus Y percent. And, you know, so that, I think that at least in part addresses your question about credibility. I think there may also be, you know, you might have a good question about credibility of the diagram itself. And I think that's a tougher issue, and that's one where, as I said before, it should be, that's doing science rather than doing statistics. You should be talking about those assumptions, because they're all qualitative assumptions. And so you should be able to debate with your colleagues and decide whether it makes sense that the arrow goes this way or that way, or there's no arrow at all. And actually, no arrow at all is often the most important thing, because when you don't draw an arrow, that's telling you that there's an independence going on somewhere that you may actually be able to check in the data. So, which is another issue I haven't really talked about, namely that you can verify some predictions of causal models. And it's something we didn't write a whole lot about in the book, because the book was pretty long as it is. So, you know, but you can read about it in Yudea's more technical book, Causality. Yeah.
Thank you for this talk. So is there a sense in which you expect that the cash value of any explanation of any phenomena, which is what science really concerns itself with, could be reduced to a very intricate, perhaps, causal diagram? I mean, do you really think that this is ultimately what's there? That
if I so the cash value of...
Of any explanation, right, okay, of a phenomenon. So I'm saying that if we really did have machines that were intelligent enough to discover, as you said, these kinds of diagrams, and presumably they become scientists one day, as they really have to take our jobs.
Yeah.
Well, then the output, do you expect it's just going to be some causal diagram? So that's just how we read. I mean, is that just a language that can kind of capture any kind of explanation we're capable of giving? Is there some kind of universality there that you see, or is it not there yet? Is there more to an explanation?
Okay. Yeah, so I don't, you know, I don't quite get the part about the cash value, but as far as universality, that's a good question. So can any causal question be reduced, or causal process be reduced to a causal diagram like this? I believe the Yudea would say yes. So the thing is that the diagrams are very qualitative, and they allow for things like, for example, moderation. Sometimes people actually don't like causal diagrams because they don't see how to express the idea that variable X affects variable Y, but it's moderated by variable Z. And like, they kind of want to draw an arrow that merges into that arrow to sort of, but the framework Yudea is using, which is not necessarily the end and final framework, but he likes what he calls structural causal models, where the meaning of an arrow, if you have variable Z and arrows from X and Y pointing into it, that means Z is actually a deterministic function of X and Y and an unobserved error function, so epsilon sub Z. And this came up in the seminar yesterday. So that's the model that Yudea is using. And the concept of a function is so broad that it can incorporate tons of stuff, including this idea of moderation. So he would say, just draw an arrow from X to Y, and from whatever, y to x, and from, no. I'm tangled up enough. Just draw an arrow from the treatment to the outcome, and also an arrow from the moderator to the outcome. And the details will sort themselves out in what are the actual functions involved. So I think his answer would be yes, this is universal.
Other questions? Maybe if I could ask one myself. So I know in the book you talk about the use of causal concepts in the legal system and in law.
Yes. Right.
You mentioned in your talk sort of the how things are changing in the medical community. Mm-hmm. What about in other?
Oh, that's yeah.
Are things changing and.
Well, that's a great question. So Rob's question was about other communities besides the medical community and how quickly are things changing there and specifically, he asked about the legal community, which is some of the examples in our book. For example, the discrimination example is totally related to the law. It's an interesting question. I don't know if lawyers have really heard this yet. I hope that our book may actually get out to them. But what's interesting is that the law actually already deals with causes and effects a great deal. So there's something called but-for causation in the law, which is exactly identical to the counterfactual notions of causation that we talk about in the book. So actually, lawyers should not have that much of a problem with this. It's only sort of a formalism that lets you deal right down on paper what they already talk about in the courtroom. So now, my saying that they should not have a problem with it doesn't mean that they won't have a problem with it, because science and math penetrate very slowly into the courtroom, and they're still struggling with incorporating mainstream statistics into the courtroom. And so having this sort of non-mainstream thing is maybe it's going to be 100 years in the future. I don't know. I hope it's not that long. But I hope that they will perceive it as a way of formalizing and rigorizing what they do anyway.
What about policy analysis?
Yeah, so, right. Yeah, okay, so like talking about other areas, one reason we use a lot of medical examples is that the acceptance has been greater, particularly among epidemiologists, for example. And so in economics, it's been more grudging, and Udaya feels as if economics is kind of a lost cause. Hopefully it's not. Hopefully this book will simplify things and make them transparent enough to where the economists want to do it too. But it is interesting how each field seems to require having a trailblazer or a bellwether to kind of set the, show the other people in the field that it can be done. And that was the case in epidemiology. Jamie Robbins, who we mentioned in the book, was a big person there, and Sandra Greenland, Uday's colleague at UCLA. And in other areas, in economics, you have people who could be trailblazers but refuse and instead say, if there's anything worthwhile here, it was already done by economists, and so we don't have to pay attention to it. And in other fields, you have different, sort of situations. But I was glad to see interview a guy who's using it in ecology, and he's a trailblazer. No one in ecology knew about this before, but he's starting to put down causal diagrams, and hopefully it'll catch on there. So it's funny how science evolves this way, and something that's so kind of, I hate to use the word revolutionary, but something that's really telling you to breaking the dogma that you've been taught. It requires advocates. It requires people who believe in it to bring it to a field. So, yeah.
Any more questions? Okay, well, if not, before we thank Dana one more time, we remind you we have snacks downstairs on the first floor if you want to ask Dana questions afterwards. And of course, there's the panel discussion this evening as well. Let's thank Dana again.